From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 375 for November 13th, 2011. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, coming to you live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And we'll be taking your calls shortly at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. I encourage you to call in early, and we'll get you on the air and spend time answering your question as thoroughly as possible. As I also do is emails. When you do send me emails and questions, I do try to answer them. There's sometimes a lot and it's hard to catch up. And when I do answer them, I try to provide you with references and information, especially from a website called uptodate.com. And again, I must say that I have no financial interest in this venture. It is a non-commercial professional site that also provides for patients, a whole section on patient information. It is evidence-based medicine. It is not financed by any companies. It is simply looking at the evidence out there and providing you with references and also general information about various medical topics of interest. And it is called uptodate.com/patients. I wasn't sure I was going to start the show today, whether I was going to talk about a new cancer treatment, at least in an animal model, that uses light to activate a drug in mice to try to keep the medication localized. I might cover that a little bit later, but I thought what was important, given the frustrations this week at the office with regards to trying to provide care to patients. And this has to do with medication availability, and really goes to my argument with respect to how we have a multiple-tier healthcare system, and it thwarts our ability to be able to provide the standard of care necessary to help people in times of need. And in this case, it has to do with pain management or chronic pain management. Some of you may have read, and it's a continuing series in the National Post, on OxyContin and how the drug was marketed and the difficulties arising from its use when used for people with conditions that may not be absolutely indicated for use, and also just how it poses difficulties with regards to withdrawing from the medication thereafter. It's a very long article, but quite interesting, and I happen to agree with what was written in there. But when you're dealing with chronic pain, you're dealing with a combination of support services, that is emotional support services, people around you, friends being supportive, helping you out for day-to-day activities, especially if you're incapacitated with the pain, medications that are available. And here we have a government where they are trying to control the use of narcotic medications, and I happen to think that's a good idea. There's the latest Narcotics Control Act that was passed on November the 1st, which tries to ensure proper identification procedures, proper prescribing habits, and monitoring the use so that people are not given too much. And at the same time, it prevents fraud and other activities that may get a hold of some of these medications. So I have to give them credit for trying to do that. But on the other hand, they're trying to control this, and they also tend to state that lots of money is being spent on various treatments for people. And so they're trying to focus on preventing, or at least trying to alleviating, some of the use in our system. And so I have several examples of patients who are suffering with severe pain. One of them is a physical ailment where their nerves in their back, the nerve roots in their lower back, are being crushed and squeezed, and they require surgery. Surgery is still 4 months away, and they are using, in this case, they are using OxyContin. But increasing the doses of this is not going to help this person any further. In fact, they're at a limit, according to guidelines, that really states that they shouldn't be, you know, you don't keep increasing that. And so what you have to do is that there are other medications that are used in concert with that. You have things like gabapentin or pregabalin or Lyrica. You have things like Sesamet, which is a cannabinoid, sort of a marijuana-type medication, but it uses a specific compound found within it to help alleviate pain. But those medications, especially Lyrica and Sesamet, are not covered. And because they are not covered, you are limited to the narcotic medication and perhaps some older medications like tricyclic antidepressants to try to help people. But you're not given, it's like fighting with one arm behind your back. You don't have the full potential to try to find the personalized treatment that might be effective in helping your patient. And this not only goes to someone who has surgical pain, but also chronic pain conditions where you're trying to prevent the overuse of narcotic medications, and yet you have a government that is encouraging, you know, reducing use, but at the same time restricting your ability to use other medications that would reduce the use or potentially reduce the use of these medications, and in fact maybe even get patients off those medications. So it's extremely frustrating. I know there was a lot of our listeners and a lot of people out there who have encountered this amongst many other types of similar situations, not necessarily for chronic pain, but certainly when there is a medication that is available that has been demonstrated to be effective and helpful, that we end up not being able to use them. People tend to suffer more. They tend to use the system more because they are suffering, and the costs go up. And I've been on record already as saying that with regards to generic medication practices, that there are many generic medications that do not work as effectively as the original medications that they were designed to replace. And people end up coming into the office with exacerbations of those conditions for which they were effectively treated and no longer are as effectively treated, hence increasing the cost even more. And we can get into that too about the reasons why there's a difference despite what people say about them being the same medications. They really are not in terms of how well they work. And so this is something that really has been bothering me more so this week because of the frustration of not being able to provide what I know is needed for these particular patients and yet being restricted from using them because, one, they cannot afford to use them, they cannot afford to buy them, and secondly, the Ministry of Health and the Ontario Drug Benefit Program does not cover it, as opposed to others who may be working in those same departments at the Ministry of Health who have insurance programs that will cover those medications for which they are denying patients who do not have the same luxury of those insurance programs. We're going to take a small break. And when we come back, we have Faye in Barrhaven who would like to talk about elevated blood calcium and Teresa in Vanier about restless leg syndrome. The remainder of our lines are available at 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
I was in love with you. 580 CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Is a long distance number. And over to line one and Faye in Barrhaven. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. I would like to know the significance of elevated blood calcium and what further tests need to be done, or is it a problem?
Well, usually the most, you know, how elevated was the blood calcium?
I don't know. It just said elevated.
Because that there are different degrees of elevation, right? Mm-hmm. You can have calcium that's elevated only by a tiny amount and you probably wouldn't do much of anything. Whereas if you had extraordinarily high serum calcium, you'd have to worry about things such as what we call hyperparathyroidism, where the parathyroid gland is making too much parathyroid hormone. It causes bone to release a lot of calcium and can increase calcium levels in your bloodstream. And you can get all kinds of side effects from that, from urinating more frequently, to drinking more, to stones in your kidneys or kidney stones. There's a whole slew of things that can happen. You know, your bones start to break down because it's losing calcium, muscle weakness. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So you have to take into account what the person is experiencing in concert with a blood test result. Because one of the problems with blood tests is that a lot are done without thinking about why we're actually doing it.
Yeah.
Right? Because many blood tests will come back with false positive results, especially if you do a lot of them. If you do a blood test where you're checking 20 different things, I can bet you one of them is going to come back saying it's abnormal, but it's abnormal not because it's really abnormal, but because there is inherent there are inherent degrees of lab error. You know, there's a range of which that you're going to end up with a particular lab error, and it'll indicate something is there when it isn't. And so the issue then becomes, great, so we've done a test. It says something is high, or in this case, elevated. But what does that truly mean if someone is feeling perfectly fine? And so you then say, well, are we going to do a whole bunch of other tests? Because elevated calcium, as I said, can be your parathyroid glands. You would check parathyroid hormone. It can be, you know, for people who are taking mega doses of vitamin D, that can happen as well. So again, the question always becomes, if we do a test, are we doing a test because we suspect that there's a problem? Because if you had those clinical signs that I mentioned before, right, mm-hmm. then you would do a test because you're trying to say, is it because of this? But if you're doing testing on someone who does not have any major clinical symptoms, then you're screening. And screening tests, especially for calcium, not really the best in terms of doing it. And also, tests like that, when someone is normal and then you do a test for the sake of just checking the calcium, you're turning people into patients when they don't have to be. Hmm. And so that's the issue.
So is there any connection with osteoporosis?
The connection with osteoporosis is if the bones are breaking down because of, in this case, something affecting calcium metabolism, aside from the normal progression, where as people get older, their bones become generally weaker, they lose calcium, you can develop different stages. Osteopenia, which is a loss of calcium, sort of in a mid-range before you get to osteoporosis, sort of a warning signal. And then osteoporosis itself, when you have significant bone density loss or calcium loss. But the most common cause of that is the aging process as opposed to anything else. The main concerns when someone has an extremely high calcium level or a level that leads to a lot of symptoms is, as I mentioned, the parathyroid gland, and the other is malignancy, because cancers can do that as well. So you can see the conundrum if they say your calcium is elevated, but you're not having any symptoms. Now you're left with the question, gee, is this my parathyroid gland? Is it cancer? Or is it nothing at all because I was feeling fine in the first place, and had we not done this test, it likely would not have made much of a difference. So that's the problem.
So is there any problem with waiting and repeating the blood test?
There is no problem waiting to repeat the blood test. In fact, you could repeat it next week and see what the calcium level was. But at the same time, there are other blood tests that you'll take. So you would also check a protein in your body called albumin, because sometimes changes in that protein level will affect the level of calcium in terms of how calcium is bound. So there is, you know, again, and this is just for our audience in general, don't do tests if there is no specific reason for doing them other than trying to satisfy a curiosity or just trying to think that somehow we're being complete. Tests are done to either eliminate a diagnosis based on clinical presentation, or if there is enough evidence to suggest that screening with a particular test will help prevent disease and improve outcomes. But to do tests as a general rule, you know, to check every year when you go for a checkup to get a whole whack of blood tests done, usually is not necessary. And that's where the problem arises, is that when we do these tests, we end up creating people who are now patients who then get extra treatments, poking and prodding, scans when it may not have been necessary in the first place to do so.
It's part of the problem with our health problem, too many useless tests.
Well, again, the test is useless if it's being used inappropriately.
Mm-hmm.
The test is useful if you, for example, if you came in and said, you know, I've been drinking a lot, I've been going to the bathroom a lot, I'm feeling weak, my muscles are spasming, you know, a whole bunch of things like that. My bone broke, I fell and my bone broke, and and it wasn't a big fall. Those kind of things, when you have something happening to someone, is not screening anymore. Now they have a condition for which you're doing investigations where the test is much more useful to rule that out. Because if you have those things and it was due to elevated calcium, you would on that test would really show an elevated calcium. This wouldn't be a slight increase. This would be a significant increase in calcium levels if that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where tests become useful. Your point is well taken, though. Doing tests for the sake of doing tests, so somehow you think that, and physicians are culpable as well, to think that I have to do something so the patient thinks I'm actually looking after them, right? So I've got to do the tests. Whereas if you explain that the tests are only as useful as the presenting state of the patient, that's a completely different matter. And there's a good book that I'm halfway through the second edition now. It's on my website in terms of a link. It's called Testing Treatments, and it is written for the general public, and it presents a terrific synopsis of why and how we do tests, how to interpret them, but also why we shouldn't do certain tests and certain screening tests. And we have to always question why things are being done to us before we just acquiesce and say, okay, let's go ahead and do the test. It always asks the question, how is this going to change the outcome and management of my health if we do this test? And that tends to reduce the number of tests that need to be done.
Well, thank you very much. It was very helpful.
You're very welcome, Faye.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Is the number to call, and a good afternoon to Teresa in Vanier.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. And yourself?
I'm very well, thanks.
Yes. The only problem I got is I have this less restless leg syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I walk, say for yesterday, but an hour and a half. And I thought maybe that will help.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had to get up in the middle of the night and, you know, walk or do it on the spot.
So it's waking you up at night.
Yeah.
Now, were you diagnosed with this? Is this someone that somebody has told you have restless leg?
No, I've had this for a while, but it wasn't as bad as now.
So what I would recommend before you make a diagnosis and say this is restless leg syndrome, so your legs shake and they cramp up and do all kinds of stuff at night?
Yeah, shake, mostly shake.
Yeah. What I would do before you make a diagnosis of restless leg syndrome is that you have to rule out other medical conditions that could cause the same thing.
Okay.
And so before you treat a condition, and restless leg syndrome can be treated and can be treated quite effectively, but before anything is thrown at you to try, it's important for you to see your physician, tell them the symptoms you're having. There are specific tests that will be done. In this case, the tests are because of a symptom that you have and what's happening to your legs, to be able to determine what the potential causes are. And there's many different things that can cause your legs to do that. I mean, there's a list that can go on for a while. So this is why it's very important to see your physician to diagnose the condition. And if it turns out at the end of the day to be restless leg syndrome, there's something they can give you that'll calm the legs down at night, that'll make it much easier for you to sleep and reduce that cramping and spasming. But before we say it's restless leg, it has to be evaluated properly.
Okay.
So I would do that this week if you can, Teresa.
Yes. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
For taking my call.
You're very, very welcome.
Yeah.
Bye-bye now.
Take care of you. Bye.
And we're going to take a small break for the news. And when we come back, we have Pierre in Gatineau. Would like to talk about possible hernias. Stuart in Iroquois has a question about stools changing color. And Joan in Orleans has a very itchy scalp, and she'd like to talk about that. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you are listening to Sunday House Call. And we'll be back in just a few minutes right after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And going right back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Pierre in Gatineau.
Hello.
Hi.
Greetings.
How are you?
Not bad. Could be better.
Yes.
Always better. Yeah, but it could be worse, too.
That's very true.
Question. I guess it's going to be a question from the X-Files or the Twilight Zone there.
All right.
I'm a vet. I did 20 years in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I had many, many accidents. And I'm wondering, from accidents from dropping off a motorcycle, trees jumping in front of you and mm-hmm. you cannot avoid them there. It's a joke.
Right.
Or you're driving through tall grass there and noticing a humongous hole and and from all those
injuries and stuff?
Injuries,
yep.
From dropping, could you develop a hernia without noticing it?
Probably not. And the reason is what a hernia is, there are different types of hernias. So let's deal with several of the more common ones.
Okay.
There's a hernia that can occur right around your belly button.
Right.
And that is called a ventral hernia. That's where the muscle, the six pack that we all like to have but never have?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. the where those muscles come together in the midline, those muscles separate.
Okay.
And so hernias are when the intestine pops through those holes in the muscle that have opened up.
Okay.
And so you can have what we call an umbilical hernia or ventral hernia, which is around the belly button or along the midline of the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
The more common hernias that also a lot of people recognize are when you get the bulges in the groin area. And that again is because of a defect, muscles weaken in a canal that takes the arteries, the nerves, the veins, other structures from the abdomen and in men down to the scrotum or testis.
Right.
And that tunnel, it's called the inguinal canal,
mm-hmm.
can sometimes break apart. And so what happens is that the intestine can push through in that area. And so that is a bulge you would feel down in the lower abdomen or groin. So that's called an inguinal hernia. The other hernias that can occur as well, you can get hernias that go down into the scrotum itself called scrotal hernias, which is just an extension of the intestine down further. You can also have what's called femoral hernias, which is a hernia that goes underneath a ligament in the pelvis down towards the leg. So there are different types
yeah.
of hernias, but mm-hmm. they're usually palpable, meaning that you usually can feel them or at least feel pain in certain areas, especially when you strain or generate abdominal pressure when,
right.
for example, lifting a box or pushing on something where you tend to hold your breath and hold the abdomen tight and you generate pressure when you do that, usually you can feel a bulge come out. Because again, the definition of a hernia is a defect in the muscle opening up literally a hole that allows something to come through. So if there is none of that mm-hmm. is noticed, then there really isn't any true hernia. You can have pre-hernia symptoms where the muscle is starting to tear and starting to separate, but nothing is poking through yet. So the answer to your question is falls in and of themselves and injuries in and of themselves can certainly cause damage, but mm-hmm. do not necessarily lead to hernias if the muscle hasn't been torn apart.
I see. So like I say, we are in the twilight zone there because it could be anything. Is that what you're saying? Or?
Well, that's right. It would be more depending on the symptoms you're having, where they're mm-hmm. located, when it happens, how often it happens, would depend then on, in terms of trying to find out what it is, doing a physical exam on the area. Sometimes you can find if there is a bit of a bulge, there are different types of physical exam techniques
right.
you can do to try and find that out. And then there's also imaging studies. Usually the most common one that's done, especially for the abdomen, if you're looking for hernias or damage to the muscle wall,
right.
is an ultrasound. Because it's non-invasive, you're not harming anybody by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not exposing them to X-rays. So again, that would be something to do if we're talking about the abdomen area or the groin or pelvic area. Usually you do an ultrasound if the physical exam warrants that kind of investigation.
How about a discal hernia? Is it possible? I'm reading because, you know, yeah. the report is in French, so I'm trying
right.
to... between L4 and L5, apparently, my disc are, you know, there would be hernia there.
Right. So now we're talking about a different type of hernia as
okay.
opposed to muscle being damaged. Now we're talking about the protrusion of a disc in the spine between the two bones.
Okay.
The disc that gets squeezed out. If you think of a... think of a peanut butter sandwich with a lot of peanut butter between the bread.
Yep.
And then you press on the bread and the peanut butter squeezes out the side.
Okay.
That's what happens to the disc in the spine if there's a disc herniation. Now, disc
okay.
herniations have different degrees of damage because, again, you can have a disc that sticks out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're concerned about and what you want to find out is, one, does the person have any symptoms? That is, are they getting pain down their leg, electric shocks, or numbness down to the foot?
Right.
So usually you do tests, again, physical mm-hmm. exam to determine that. And also, is this pushing on one of the nerves that's coming out of the spine? Because it usually goes either to one side, to the right, or to the left. And depending on how significant that is
right.
if it's herniating, but it's not pushing on the nerve at all,
mm-hmm.
you usually leave those things alone. You don't touch them.
Oh, no. My
yeah.
doc told me, you know, only if I would be paralyzed there, I'm able walking. I did
yeah.
the veteran parade
right.
there, and I had no problem walking.
Okay, so what this now means, though, is that,
mm-hmm.
and here is, again, what I mentioned earlier in the show.
Mm-hmm.
When we do tests,
right.
in this case, it was an imaging study. Was it a CT scan of your spine? Was that what happened?
I just remember going through a big donut
type. Okay,
yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm.
So, again... the reason for doing those tests is if that test is going to show something that's going to mean either in this case surgery or some other thing that's going to fix it. But
mm-hmm.
if you're able to walk and you're not in much pain and you're able
nope.
to function,
yep.
then that test in and of itself, even though it shows that there's a herniation, means nothing
mm-hmm.
because we're not going to do anything. We're going to leave you alone because
exactly.
surgery to try and fix a problem that isn't causing you a problem is going to give you a problem.
Exactly, you know, and the back there is so, the back is so iffy if you
yeah.
go playing it there that you can end up worse than you are there.
Well, and that's exactly it. So again,
mm-hmm.
the question always is, the statement is, you only do tests if it is going to mean that it's going to tell us something different, that's
right.
going to change what we're planning to do in terms of management and treatment.
Okay.
If, for example, again, you come in, you say, you know, have a bit of pain, but I'm able to move around, I'm able to walk, I'm not paralyzed, I don't get tingling or numbness in my foot,
mm-hmm.
I'm functioning well, I would say to you, there's no reason to do a CT scan of your back because, again, there's nothing to fix right now. If on the other hand, you came in and said, you know, I my leg gives out, I get
mm-hmm.
tingling, burning pain, numbness on my foot, I can't feel the bottom of my foot, and I trip
right.
and I fall, I would say, we have to find out what's doing it because you can't function like that and we need to fix it.
So, why I was asking you those questions is because I'm going in front of the board, the medical board of the veteran
mm-hmm.
there soon.
Right.
And all, you know, every time I had the injuries, it always ended up on my legs, either my heels were, you
right.
know, twisted
mm-hmm.
there, and but never, my back was
right.
never, but...
Disc herniations occur also
mm-hmm.
as we get older. So it's very, again, if you had those accidents but
mm-hmm.
have been pain-free and functioning well
yep.
afterwards,
yep.
it's unlikely that you had any severe damage to your spine enough
mm-hmm.
to cause the disc to herniate like that. So,
okay.
again, disc herniations, many people... myself
mm-hmm.
included, I might have one too. But the point
okay.
is that it's part of the natural history of what happens to the spine as you age.
Right.
You know, there are different factors that can contribute to disc herniations. But again, they only matter when they are clinically significant. That is, if they are causing dysfunction, causing pain, interfering
mm-hmm.
with normal daily activities, impairing quality of life, that's when you do something to fix it. But
I see.
As a part of I know we can do CT scans on 100 people out there, and
mm-hmm.
I'll bet you we'll find all kinds of weird stuff happening to their spines.
I believe
but,
you.
But you don't do anything about it because it's just part
mm-hmm.
of the process of who they are, their aging, and their activity. So hard to say to link up the accidents that you had
right.
with what's happening to your back.
I see. Well, I won't take much of your time because I could talk and talk and talk, but
okay,
I know
Pierre.
Other people want to talk, so we'll try again another time.
All righty, Pierre.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And we have a few lines available at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. And we're going to go to line four, and Joan in Orleans. Good afternoon.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Is it Joan?
Yes.
Yes, hi. I'm so delighted to talk to you. I love your show
thank
when
you.
I can get to hear it. And you sound like such a cool doctor.
Oh, thank
I really
you.
Appreciate it.
Thank
anyway,
you.
I'm hoping that you're going to think of something that can relieve my problem with my scalp, which
okay.
has been since about 1996. I was losing my hair very badly
mm-hmm.
and had a very extremely itchy scalp. I went to the doctor. He recommended a dermatologist,
mm-hmm.
and she recommended that I use this cortisostoroid cream, the
right.
Elocom lotion.
Mm-hmm.
So I use that, but it was so bad that it would just burn, and especially at night when I go to bed.
Okay.
And so anyway, so then I used a lot of the special shampoos, you know, all the different
mm-hmm.
Shampoos for your scalp. I stopped coloring my hair and very careful with any products that I use.
Right.
And I still just can't seem to get rid of this itchy scalp. And I just wondered if you had any suggestions or cures or what I could use to see if I could alleviate this.
Well, the first thing is to confirm that the diagnosis that you had originally was correct, because they probably diagnosed something called seborrheic dermatitis, which is... Did you get flaking on your scalp and the skin got dry and cracked?
She couldn't really see anything when she checked it.
Okay.
No.
Because
it doesn't show anything, you know, but it just, especially when I go to bed at night, it's like so itchy. And so when I put this cream on, it does calm it down,
mm-hmm.
Which I can't get renewed anymore. They don't renew that. But anyway, I just wondered if you knew of anything that would be causing that. And the other thing was the vitamin B. I upped that a lot. I
mm-hmm.
take a lot of supplements. I'm 70 and
okay.
take a lot of supplements, very active and everything. But
okay.
It's such an annoying problem. And I just wondered you would suggest, or if you had any idea what might be causing that.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do, Joan, is actually we'll take a small break.
Because
mm-hmm. there's a few questions
sure.
that I have and also a few
sure.
ideas, and then we can
sure.
review that.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to take a small break. I'm going to
sure.
put Joan on hold, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about what could possibly be causing that itchy scalp. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're heading right back to the phone lines and continuing our conversation with Joan. So, Joan,
yes.
is it just the scalp? There's no other area of your body that gets itchy?
Not really.
Okay. No. So, no rashes on your scalp?
No.
No scaling on it?
No.
So, no flakes or anything, dandruff
no.
type of stuff? Okay. So, what you have in terms of, or what you don't have in terms of the diagnosis, is it's unlikely that you have what we call seborrheic dermatitis, which is what those shampoos were designed for, and the Elocom was designed for, the topical cortisones that you're using. Usually, I mean, seborrheic dermatitis usually gives you dry skin, it flakes, it's itchy, it's a type of eczema of the scalp.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not having that, if you have no rash
no.
and no scaling, then something else has to be irritating your scalp. So the treatments then, obviously, if they're not working, are not working because the diagnosis is not correct. So we have to then ask the question, what is it on your scalp only, right? What is it that is irritating it to the where it's itchy? Is it itchy during the day as well?
Not really, just mainly at night when I'm laying down and then it starts.
Okay. So
maybe because I'm busy at all, you know, during the day, I don't know, but it just gets extremely itchy at night.
Now, at night, do you tend to take showers at night or wash your hair at night?
Not really, and I've tried cutting back on my hair washes.
Okay. Is there anything that you put on the scalp? If, for example, questions would be, you know, any hair coloring, anything where you're, where hairsprays, yeah, anything like that?
I've stopped hair coloring a little while back, and so I just went natural.
Okay.
And like I say, I'm quite careful with products that I use and,
okay,
you know, sort of thing. So it just kind of mystifies me as to what could be causing that.
Well, when there is itchiness on the scalp, I mean, an itchy scalp means, mm-hmm, that you have histamine being released under the skin. Histamine is a chemical compound that causes some inflammation, mm-hmm, and is a response, body's response to something that's irritating it. Mm-hmm. And so if it's itchy at night, something has to be causing that kind of itchy sensation.
So, could it be possibly something in a diet? Would that have anything to do with something I'm eating that isn't, like I'm a vegan eater?
Right.
But I wondered if it was wheat or something like that.
It's unlikely because usually if it's something someone is eating, you would get a reaction all over the place,
okay,
because it would be in your bloodstream, which would carry, mm-hmm, it pretty much, you know, on your arms, pretty much, well, obviously everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we're then left with, okay, do we do a skin biopsy to try and see what's happening to the skin for signs of any chronic inflammation or something that could be, that could give us a clue? That is possible. It's, you know, the skin is not red. It looks normal, at least, mm-hmm, you know, from general inspection, from what you're describing, it, mm-hmm, it seems normal. But a biopsy would be something to do if we've exhausted all the possibilities of what could externally be causing that problem.
Okay.
Are there any medications that you're taking?
No, the only thing I take is Avapro for blood pressure, and they change that to the generic type there, the Irbesartan.
Okay.
I just started that.
Okay, so the itchiness that you've had on your scalp was before they changed that medication over?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I just started taking, they just renewed this and gave me the substitute, which I presume is okay.
As long as
as long as
it's controlling your blood pressure, then that's fine. Okay. So that's where you'd have to monitor, and as long as it's working, then that's fine.
Sure. Okay.
So really, again,
biopsy
is, again, if it's enough that it's irritating you and that the treatments that you're using are not effective, mm-hmm, or you're not happy with the way they're, mm-hmm, they're going, then a biopsy might be helpful. It may not show anything. Remember, you're dealing with a scalp that looks essentially normal, but again, it has to be happening for a reason. So you're not making this up, you know?
No,
so
that's right.
There's something that is causing the scalp to become itchy at night.
Mm-hmm.
We've eliminated medications. We've eliminated stuff that you've put on the skin.
Mm-hmm.
You're not using irritating shampoos. Are you using things like baby shampoo,
yes,
that kind of thing? Yeah.
Yes.
So again, nothing to really irritate the scalp.
Yep.
You know, sometimes things that contain fragrance or perfumes in it can also irritate the scalp because they contain alcohols,
mm-hmm,
and that can cause some damage. It's not from anything that's on your head. You're not wearing anything on your head, are
no,
you?
No.
So again, we're
and
left.
Supplements wouldn't have anything to do with it. They're all healthy things.
Yeah, well, unlikely, especially if you're not taking mega doses of supplements.
Well, I was taking a lot of vitamin B because of the hair loss, because I was losing so much, even my eyebrows.
Right.
But at that time, but it's slowed down a bit. But it still comes out quite a bit, but not as much as it did in '96 or something.
And thyroid disease was eliminated also?
Yes.
Okay, so you've had a blood test to check your thyroid and,
mm-hmm,
such. Okay. Well, really, you know, if we're looking to try and diagnose if there's anything going on with the skin, a punch biopsy, which is very tiny, it's 2 millimeters in size,
mm-hmm,
it can be done in the office. I mean, you'll get a little bit of bleeding and you may need a stitch to, mm-hmm, close it up,
mm-hmm,
but that might be it might be helpful.
Okay.
If it comes back negative for anything, it's helpful in some ways because what you're trying to rule out is any, you know, autoimmune diseases that sometimes can cause an itchy mm-hmm scalp, so that is possible. So that might be something to do. Other things as well, especially at night, using antihistamines in the interim. I don't know if you've used antihistamines before.
Antihistamines? For, mm-hmm.
Yeah, things like, you know, over-the-counter stuff for allergies. You know,
okay,
it's, you know, I don't want to mention specific names, but I mean, you have a list of things like you know, Benadryl.
That if I was using those, it might have caused it, you mean?
No, it might help alleviate
it. Oh, it might help it. Okay.
Yes, things like, you know, Benadryl, Claritin, Allegra, Arius. You know, if I've missed one, it's not intentional.
Yes.
So that can be something to try as well to see if it controls the itchiness. Mm-hmm. If it does, and this is, it's one of the ways to help make a diagnosis, because if it does alleviate the itchiness on your scalp, especially since it's only at night, so you take it about an hour before going to bed.
Okay.
If it alleviates that discomfort, then that really does tell us that you're getting histamine that's released in the scalp. And that
does tell
us that there is some sort of reaction going on in the skin when you lie down that is irritating the scalp.
Okay.
You know, who knows? Does it itch before you go into bed or only when you're in bed?
It's just when I'm laying down. And
okay, so then the question then also to think about, is there anything on the pillow that's irritating your scalp?
That I can think of. I've just about thought about everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are some of the questions that we have to think about. But ultimately, using an antihistamine, if not contraindicated for you, using an over-the-counter antihistamine before you go to bed, if it eliminates the itch, that actually helps in making a diagnosis.
Okay.
You're doing this not necessarily for treatment, but you're doing this to try and figure out a mechanism of why this is irritating you.
Sure.
So these are some of the things I would suggest to you to do. At least it's different from what you've done so far.
That's good. Yeah.
And see if that makes a difference.
And is there a reason why this Elocom lotion is discontinued, or that it's not able to be refilled again? Or?
No, there's no reason why not. It can be renewed. It's still on the market.
They told me that I couldn't get it refilled. I had to go to something else or whatever. But I just found at least it stops the itching, you know.
And if it does, that tells us also about the mechanism of the condition. So. I would do these things, head back to your physician and see if we can figure out, and let me know what happens.
I will. And thank you ever so much. And thank you for being so patient.
Oh, you're very welcome, Joan.
Bye-bye now.
And unfortunately, I think that is going to wrap up the show. My sincere apologies to Stuart. He's been waiting a long time and wasn't able to get to your call. If you do call next week, right at the beginning of the show, I will guarantee you that you will get on and we can talk about the condition. As well to Anne and Rockland, my apologies. My thanks to Ted Raymond for producing Sunday House Call this Sunday, and I wish you all the best this week, and we'll be back with another edition of Sunday House Call next week. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week. A glass of wine in a hand.